Now, the Association of Catholic Priests says the pattern of celebrating both First Holy Communions and Confirmations has been troubling for many priests and people in recent years. In a statement issued yesterday, the Association said children are presented for both sacraments, even though many of them rarely, if ever, attend any celebration of the Eucharist, either before or after their big day. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line by Father Paddy Byrne. He's currently based in Abbey Leaks, County Leash, and is formerly of the Newbridge Parish. Paddy, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you, and good afternoon to you and all your listeners.
And thank you indeed for joining us. The Association of Catholic Priests is very strongly suggesting that preparation for the sacraments be removed from during school time. Do you hope that in so doing, that only the parents who are motivated by their faith will then put their children forward to engage in those sacraments?
Well, I think it's important just to set out a conversation very much in the context of how Pope Francis invites those who choose to be part of Catholic parishes to partake in sacraments. And it's a very inclusive one. He says that sacraments are never trophies just to be handed out to those who tick the right boxes. And in no way, my interpretation of what the Association of Catholic Priests' ambition is to be authoritative in creating an exclusive club entirely just for those who tick the box of practicing faith. However, I think it's a wider context, and I think the context is pragmatic because less than 5% of young families, and I respect other choice, I'm not making judgment, but this is fact, that come to church regularly, if ever. I think it's absolutely disproportionate the control Catholic Church in Ireland has on education in terms of the management structure of schools, where the vast majority have made a choice not to partake, in fact interpret the Catholic Church as toxic, and yet this church is given control in terms of management structure of schools. And I think one of the things that needs to be addressed, because I'm passionate, and indeed many priests and people on the ground are passionate in our resolve to rejuvenate a church that's yearning for youth and life at this time. So I think we must celebrate sacraments, and I include baptism and all sacraments, in a more authentic manner. If not, what we have is blatantly a one-day wonder, a superficial sense of a cultural day out, and after that there is never a connection again. So we have to be honest and say, how can we allow our parishes to grow? And in no way, by the way, am I suggesting that we don't acknowledge the huge work that has happened over many decades and generations in Catholic schools. But I think primarily the function of preparation for the sacraments mustn't be in a classroom, but within the context of the family who make the choice. And I think it's disproportionate the amount of people who come for First Communion when we evaluate those who come to church. It's just not adding up.
And arguably, removing preparation for the sacraments from schools would also mean that it is an active and conscious choice on the parts of families to put their children forward for those sacraments. Because I think everybody has heard anecdotally parents say of their children that they don't want them not to make their First Holy Communion or their confirmation because everybody else in the class is doing it. And there's no mention of faith in those conversations. It's more about the cultural Catholicism, the cultural tradition of those rites of passage, which for a lot of families is utterly separate to any form of faith.
Well said, and I think that's basic and that's the fact. And I don't think it's fair on a second class child to have to say, well, because I'm in second class, I have to make my First Communion, and it becomes part of the occasion, making the sacrament with their classmates, and identifiable for the parents who make that very sensible choice. We don't belong to this church, we have issues with this church, we want our child to make their own determined decision in their own time. And I think if you look across Europe, particularly in countries that have gone through the secular wave that we are currently still feeling, but now are post-Christian, particularly France, Spain, Italy itself, whereby the sacraments are always the job of the parish catechist, being accompanied and supported by the choice of the family. And I think when parents are more active in that important role, and that very sacred role in which parents are supposed to, when they present children for baptism, they make a promise that they will bring the child in the knowledge and practice of faith, that when that is realized, if it's genuine, then we go and make our communion. But I think one of the things that the Church in Ireland, if it takes seriously the pandemic, that we have gone through what has been a monumental shift in our behaviour, not being able to celebrate Mass, for instance. There's many parishes, including in Newbridge and places, that haven't had communion up to 2 years. Mm. But if we just go back to the old way that we were doing it and don't take leadership on this, I think we're in for our fall will actually be accelerated. And I just think, because I'm passionate about the need for renewal, the need for our church to grow in the future, but it's going to be much smaller, but at least it should be more authentic. I think the day of just taking a box because I'm in sixth class or because I want to get communion, mm-hmm. and I feel I have to, I think there should be far more choice. Ireland prides itself on choice, and I say that with conviction and respect. I think we live in a secular world where we decide how we practice or don't practice in terms of our own moral code, in terms of how we partake with religion if we make that option. Mm-hmm. But I think that it's absolutely disproportionate that 90% of children still come for communion and confirmation. And I don't want to be a party pooper, but there should be rites of passage. But rites of passage in a secular world should not just be determined by a sacrament that was for everybody 60, 40 years ago. That's not the Ireland we live in, and it's time that we embrace this reality for to bring a sense of authenticity to the sacrament, but also to bring a new vibrancy to our parishes.
Well, Father Paddy Byrne, based in Abbey Leaks, County Laois, but formerly of the parish of Newbridge, thank you indeed for joining us. Do you agree with him? Should preparation for all of the sacraments be removed from schools entirely? If you were the parent of a child in second or sixth class, this could mean additional preparation for the sacraments on Saturdays or Sundays. It would mean that parents may not be able to say things like, well, my child is going to go forward for it because everybody else in his or her class is going forward and I don't want them to miss out. It would mean the creation of different secular cultural rites of passage for children of those age to mark their growth into adulthood. Let us know what you think. Text or WhatsApp 0833 97 97 97. WhatsApp into us just now this moment. I agree with everything that priest said. He's 100% right. After sacraments, you never see parents or the children in the church again until they get married. The last 10 years or so, communion and confirmation day is more of a day out for the parents than the children. Thank you very much for your lovely message, Teresa. I did have a lovely break. Now on to matters completely different. The Department of Education says teachers will not have to be vaccinated when schools reopen at the end of this month. It's been a very quick summer. It's also confirmed that teachers will not have to disclose their vaccination status in order to be allowed back into the classroom. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line by Eamon Dennehy, President of the ASTI, the Association of Secondary Teachers in Ireland. Eamon, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thanks, Ciara.
I imagine on an individual basis, your members will be very much welcoming that statement by the department.
The situation with regard to the STI is that we had been, campaigning very hard that members would have access to vaccinations, and we thought that this was a very important part of making sure that schools could stay functioning in a safe manner.
Mm.
So we are, we would be concerned as well about actually what's occupying our mind even more now is, we'll say, vulnerable members of our organisation that are not going to be covered properly by the vaccination rollout. for example, pregnant women, the early stages of their pregnancy will not be vaccinated. And people as well in the very high risk category, they're also very vulnerable because they may be on medications, etc., that may render them very susceptible to COVID, even though they may have been vaccinated. So the majority of our concern is around that issue at present. And we really do want to see schools opening in a safe as possible manner. And vaccination is part of that. The other issue that I'm delighted is happening as well, and the ASCI in general is happy with, is to see that the vaccine has been offered to the 12 to 18-year-olds, which means as well that some of the students will actually be teaching will also be vaccinated, and hopefully into the future many of them will, or many more. So our position would be, you know, we want to see people vaccinated. The issue around people having concerns about being vaccinated or not wanting to be vaccinated, that's really about a constitutional right, and I suppose that's been discussed at a higher level there between ICTU and the government itself, because it's not just teachers that come up with this, we'll say, are often all workers really, and some sort of a general, I suppose, protocol or procedure or whatever you would call it, a directive needs to be formulated for that.
Because teaching in a classroom, it is a workplace, but it's a very specialist, almost unique workplace. And I don't think any employer in the state currently is entitled to ask a member of staff whether they've been vaccinated or not, or whether they intend to be or not. So if that is going to change, it will change for all workers, not just teachers. But there's 3.5 weeks now, a little bit less until the term begins. All adults who wish to have a vaccine would at that point have been offered a vaccination. So the concern, I would imagine, Eamon, rests with those who cannot, for a variety of reasons, undertake a vaccination program. You touched on some of those cohorts there, or who may be additionally vulnerable. What measures do you need, and do your members need to be in place in order for those teachers to feel more secure in the classroom?
Well, I think particularly that very small cohort have to be given very serious consideration with regard to if they are vulnerable. I certainly would, measures would have to be taken that would, as close as possible, guarantee their safety. What they would be exactly, I think, again, that needs to be looked into and discussed, because there are meetings between various unions, including the teachers' unions and health and the departments of education and health, with regard to these issues, and hopefully proper measures will be put in place.
Do you have any sense at the moment, Eamon, or any personal preference as to what those additional measures could look like?
Well, I mean, I could speculate, but I'm very much inclined to wait for a proper decision rather than just, speculate about what happened. But I think I can definitely sympathise with people who have anxieties about going back to work not properly looked after. Now, having said that, it is important that as an ASTI member, I appreciate the measures that have been taken. A lot of good work has been done with regard to monitors, etc., in classrooms, and CO2 monitors, which would help to ensure that the air that's in the classroom is fresh and is being exchanged enough. And all these measures, some of them small, some of them very big, help to keep the place safe.
And aren't the powers that be to whom you have alluded, Eamon, leaving this a little bit late? Because if these additional measures, whatsoever they may be, require any form of procurement, any form of installation, there's very little time left to do that.
Well, I think it's well underway. That's the impression that I have. But as you say, it's urgent, all right. And I certainly hope they can meet the timetable with regard to it. But I would be hopeful about it. I don't know for definite, but I would hope that very early September, whatever measures need to be put in place will be in place.
Well, Eamon Dennehy, President of the ASTI, thank you indeed for joining us. Coming up after the break, we will be talking about that keynote report released by a United Nations climate panel today. I'll be joined by Professor John Sweeney on that, and we will hear about a blood donation drive in Athy. Human activities are the indisputable cause of climate change, according to a new report published today by the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. It's warning that if nothing, no action is taken, or insufficient action is taken, global warming of between 1.5 and 2 degrees will occur by the end of the century. To discuss this, I'm joined on the line by John Sweeney. He's Emeritus Professor of Geography at Maynooth University and member of Antashka's Climate Committee. John, you're very welcome to the programme.
Good afternoon, Ciara.
This is as stark a report, I think, as one could imagine on this, and it really underscores the situation in which the entire planet finds itself.
Yes, I think we can't underestimate the importance of this report. It's part of the UN cycle, which really only produces IPCC assessment reports every 7 or 8 years, and they are the kind of gold standard, therefore, that governments across the world rely on, and 195 governments have already signed up acceptance of this particular report. It's based on a scrutiny of about 14,000 scientific papers. It gets comments from all of the atmospheric scientists around the world, about 80,000 comments at this stage. And what it's telling is really, it is, as you say, quite a stark message. It's adding to what has been said in previous assessment reports, but it's telling us really that the window for opportunity to tackle climate change is now closing even more rapidly than we thought. We did anticipate that we would have a couple of decades before we passed the crucial 1.5 degrees of global warming threshold. Now we think it's going to happen sometime in the 2030s, in the next 10 to 15 years, and that we will pass the 2-degree dangerous climate change threshold sometime in the 2040s. And this is really quite worrying, because these are the kind of thresholds at which really unknown things can start happening to our climate, and things like changes in the Gulf Stream, things like loss of our coral reefs, loss of our glaciers, loss of our summer sea ice, which may have as yet unforeseen knock-on effects for climate, even here in Ireland. And what this report is telling us really is that the opportunities for ameliorating some of those extreme events which may then occur is also dwindling, and dwindling very fast. So I wouldn't describe it as a wake-up call. I think it's more a sort of 999 emergency call, if you like. And this is coming from the accumulated wisdom of all the world's atmospheric scientists. So we can't sneer at it. We can't doubt it. We can't go down the sceptic road any longer, or the contrarian road. It really is saying to us that unless we get our act together quickly, and within the next 20 to 40 years, the people who will be around, and they will be children and grandchildren, of course, as well as many of our current population, they will suffer from a really difficult climate situation, which will inhibit our ability to support people on the planet and cause untold mayhem in areas around the world as well.
I often think in the discussion of climate change among lay people that it seems like a faraway abstract concept, because in a lot of instances you're talking about places which are many thousands of miles or kilometres away from where you may be sitting and taking part in that conversation. But for example, over the next 20 to 40 years, John, if the action that is indicated in this report and indicated by you and your colleagues and your peers is not taken here, and we heard grave predictions as to the health or lack thereof of the Gulf Stream in recent days, here in Ireland we could see more extreme weather like Storm Emma's every winter. greater flooding. The heat wave that we all enjoyed for 5 days would get old very quickly if it lasts for weeks or months.
Yes, you're quite right. And in fact, you know, the report does tackle this problem of changing extremes. And, you know, to give you an example, it talks, for example, about the changes in temperature extremes which may occur with our current temperatures, and estimates that the kind of event that would only occur once in 50 years in pre-industrial times is now occurring five times in 50 years, and will, if we get to 2 degrees, occur something like 8.6 times as often. So we're seeing that, if you like, the kind of extremes, we saw a little of it last month with the heat wave, but those kind of events, the flooding events, the drought events, those kind of events will not only become much more frequent, but they will become much more severe. And the report also says that we're going to see extremes occurring in places where we never had extremes of that magnitude before. And that's quite worrying for a place like Ireland, which we don't have not an awful lot of really major extremes such as experienced at the moment in southeastern Europe, or the floods in China, or even in Germany. So it's a kind of warning signal for us that you know, we're on a track where we're losing the race. We talked about the race between vaccines and the virus quite a lot, but there's a race also between emissions reduction and climate hell, and we're losing that race very badly at the moment, both globally and even nationally, where we haven't delivered in Ireland on our own national obligations over the past 2 decades.
And are likely to continue to miss those targets. But it does seem, by certainly the tone of this report, that the targets themselves are insufficient.
It does. And I think what the report is saying to us is that, you know, we've talked about climate neutrality by 2050, but that's too far in the future. We really have to think about doing things much more quickly, especially if we're going to hit those threshold points much more soon than we thought we were going to. So our target, even for Ireland, for example, is 51% by 2030. That doesn't represent a fair share of the remaining dwindling carbon budget that the world has. We're eking out more of it for ourselves, and we're doing so at the expense of poorer countries. We think Ireland is almost insignificant at times, and we look to China and India and other countries, but we have to remember that even here in Ireland, we emit more greenhouse gases than the 300 million poorest people on the planet. So our actions as individuals, as a nation, do have direct consequences for the ability of a farmer in Malawi or in Zambia to feed their family. So we can't detach the actions from one part of the world from the consequences elsewhere. And that's why it's so imperative that everybody plays their part, and that we stop pointing the finger at other countries, and within Ireland that we stop pointing the finger at other sectors, but that we share this burden equitably and really tackle the problem, which has now got to the stage where really drastic action is necessary if we're to preserve sustainability for those that come after us.
It does seem that while there is an inclination to pay a degree of lip service to the scale of the action required, that governments right across the globe, blocks right across the globe, national collectives right across the globe, and multinational organisations which span the globe, aren't either individually or collectively inclined to take the scale of action necessary.
Yes, I think it's true that the events that have happened since the Paris Agreement in 2015 have been really disappointing. We haven't even agreed the rule book for Paris at this stage, 6 years later. And we've looked at the pledges that governments and countries have made in detail. And when you do that, you find that there's an awful lot of aspiration, an awful lot of woolly statements, and that reality is that many countries are being driven by their own national self-interest just like we as individuals, they're often driven by our own individual self-interest. So we're not delivering on those pledges and on those promises. And that's why the conference at the end of the year, the COPs conference in Glasgow, is so important. It, in a sense, it's the last chance saloon for the world to try and get that national self-interest paradigm overruled by global community interests. And that's going to be a really difficult task because, as you say, in the background, there are very, very powerful economic forces driven by the financial imperative of making profits in the short term rather than looking at the consequences in the medium and long term. And that's something we have to tackle ruthlessly at a national level as well.
Well, Professor John Sweeney, Emeritus Professor of Geography at Maynooth University and a member of Antashka's Climate Committee. Thank you indeed for joining us. A two-day blood donation drive begins in Athy in a smidge over an hour. To tell us all about it, I'm joined on the line by Irish Blood Transfusion Service National Donor Services Manager, Stephen Cousins. Stephen, you're very welcome to the programme.
Thank you.
I would imagine, as always, you're appealing for as many people to donate as is possible, but COVID means there are certain strictures in place.
There are indeed, and well, the key thing is that we try to control the numbers coming in, and the way we do that is through appointments. So any donors that want to come into the clinic for Athy, there's a number to call, and if they make that appointment, obviously we'll give them a time that they can come in. And what that means is with appointments, we can control the number of people coming in. That means we can maintain the social distance, and it also means we can get people through the clinic as quickly as possible. So it works very well from that point of view.
For your staff, though, it does mean the clinics are open for a longer duration of time than they would have been, let's say, in 2019.
A little bit, although it's probably more controlled. So if you think about it, before we had the appointment system, before COVID, donors would know that you could be lucky or unlucky depending on when you turned up to the clinic. And, for example, the clinic might be close to finishing and 20, 30 people might arrive. Well, our staff would have to work through the clinic with those 20 or 30 people, whereas now we can control those numbers. So, you know, before the end of the clinic, there's not a big long queue and there's still only about, you know, maybe 6-10 people arriving in the last 20 minutes. So for staff point of view, it's actually worked out really, really well because it takes away that feeling of being overwhelmed with donors coming at them, and it keeps the clinic busy throughout the day as well. So it works out very well for them, but very much from a donor point of view, you know, we've heard a lot of good things from donors about it's just made the clinics more enjoyable, and as I say, they can rely on kind of getting in and out. Generally an hour and 15 minutes is the max nearly you'd have for most donors at this stage.
And the clinic today and tomorrow, 3:45 to 8 p.m. at the Church of Ireland Centre on the Janeville Road. And the number which I'll give out again before the end of the programme is 059 913 2125. That's 059 913 2125. Stephen, I know earlier in the summer that IBTS had to contract blood from outside the state because of low stocks of supply of certain blood types. Has that situation improved at all?
It's probably improved. So we imported mainly O negative blood, and certainly our O negative blood stocks have improved somewhat. But overall, the general trend is the same. You know, it's come about mainly for two reasons. That firstly, the hospital demand has gone up, so very significantly in the maybe I'd say 5 of the last 7-8 weeks, the hospital supply has been around 2,400, 2,500 issues a week, whereas before COVID, that was around 2,200, just over that. So it's really the hospitals trying to catch up on a lot of what they've had to put off during COVID. So that means the demand's gone up, but at the very same time, the availability of donors has probably fallen for a number of reasons, not least that the lockdown has eased everything, and so people have more activities, kids are playing Gaelic games even, that kind of stuff. But it's also summertime, and summer always tends to be very difficult to get donors in the door. So that's definitely impacting. So that trend is still there, that it's harder to get the donors at the moment, and yet the hospitals are busier. So we are, like, at the moment, the supply this morning is 4.8 days, and, you know, that's challenging enough. But within that, the two blood groups in particular that are challenging are O pos, which is 3.7 days, and A pos at 4.4 days. Both of those blood groups make up 73% of the population. So there's not a lot of wriggle room. And that's it's really important that you know, we kind of plan from week to week, really. So when we have clinics in place, that those clinics are successful is really crucial to ensuring that we can keep going with the hospitals each week.
Well, Stephen Cousins, National Donor Services Manager at the Irish Blood Transfusion Service, thank you indeed for joining us. And the number, if you would like to make an appointment to donate blood in Athy today or tomorrow, is 059 91 32 12 5. 059 91 32 12 5. And there are clinics a little later this month in Kildare Town. Let me get you that information. The 23rd and the 24th, if that might suit you better. They'll be in the Educate Together National School, Melitta Road. So just to mark your card there, the appointment number is the same and they will be 3:45 to 8 p.m. 23rd and the 24th of August. Plastic debris has been found in thousands of nests across the northwest of Europe and is posing a serious threat to seabirds in that region. That's according to a very lengthy four-year study. And to discuss this, joined on the line by Dr. Neil James. He's a postdoctoral research associate at the Environmental Research Institute at the University of the Highlands and Islands. Neil, you're very welcome to the programme.
Hello, thank you.
So, chicks are literally being hatched in a sea of plastic in parts of coastal Europe.
That's right. What we're seeing is all over northwest Europe, we're seeing a lot of plastic debris and other debris as well, but predominantly plastics are ending up in nests. So plastics can impact birds in different ways. Birds can ingest plastics, they can become entangled in it, but what we're seeing is that a lot of species are also using it as nest material, especially building their nests out of plastics.
I would imagine it's clearly a very durable nest-building material, but it would increase perhaps the mortality rate amongst chicks and fledglings.
That's right, and we see quite a lot of instances where there's they've become entangled or hanged, and so a lot of dead birds are being found in quite a lot of different species. So in Grasholm Island, just off Wales, for example, they're rescuing or recovering about 65 individuals each year, which have been kind of hung in the fishing nets and the other plastic material that's been used to make their nests. So it can be quite a lot of individuals.
And I know that as part of the study, you looked at over 10,000 nests across the UK, Norway, Iceland, Sweden and the Faroe Islands, quite a vast geographical area, 12% of them, so somewhere sort of in the region of 1,600 found to contain plastic debris. There was one bird species in particular found to be most affected, the Atlantic puffins. And puffins are very cute, and I know most people love them, but is there a particular, and with good reason, is there a particular reason, Neil, why these species were so badly affected?
Puffins are very cute, but I think people who work on puffins also know of their aggressive nature and their big bills as well. So the plastics we're finding in their nests, it was from quite a few colonies. It wasn't that many, but we looked at, but it was still quite a lot of nests. Mm. And it was about 67%, so about two-thirds of nests had plastic debris in it. And we don't really know why that the puffin is more, it's doing this to a greater extent than other species. So other auk species, such as common guillemots, they don't really seem to be doing it. So what we think is that where these species were, where the puffins were that we looked at, it's probably just using the available material. So where there's an absence of natural material like grass and things like that, or maybe seaweed, then perhaps they're using just what's locally available. And if there is more pollution in the local environment, they're using those to a greater extent.
That's what I was going to ask you. Where you can't know for each breeding pair, but where would you imagine that the plastic is coming from? I know a proportion of it would be marine plastic pollution. Some of it could be pilfered from bins near where they're nesting, etc. It isn't necessarily all litter strewn in a breeding colony.
No, you're right. So it's whatever kind of locally available, perhaps from the sea. Different bird species make their nests out of different materials, so it depends on the bird. But what we're seeing, that the types of plastics we're we're seeing most frequently in nests are either thread-like plastic, so things like fishing nets and netting, things like that, or it's the kind of film, so things like, you know, like plastic bags would be made of, or single-use packaging. So those are the kind of main plastics that we're seeing. Depending on the species, some will forage in the sea, and some will forage kind of in the surrounding colony area, so they're using kind of whatever's available.
And I would imagine whatever kind of plastic they're using, wheresoever individual breeding pairs are finding that plastic and where in the study area they may be, the net result is the same, in that in one way or another they're being poisoned, killed, or otherwise having their lives shortened by proximity to this plastic.
Yeah, so actually we're at the very kind of early stages of trying to understand what it means to have lots of nests filled with plastic, and we don't really have a good handle on it, so that's kind of the next stage, and that's exactly where we're at now. We know that plastics adsorb pollutants, so they can be kind of concentrated with these kind of potentially harmful chemicals. We don't know if that has an impact on the birds or the eggs or the chicks. We don't know risk of entanglement is, and how many individuals are entangled for each different species, and whether that has an impact on the total population. But there's so many unknowns around this that we really don't know. We don't know if the plastics kind of affect how kind of warm of an environment that the nest is as well, because of course the chicks need a kind of warm environment to before they're born, before they hatch out of the eggs, they need a kind of a warm environment to help them grow. And we don't know if the kind of increased plastic in the nest changes that at all.
Well, Dr. Neil James, postdoctoral research associate at the Environmental Research Institute at the University of the Highlands and the Islands, thank you indeed for joining us.